The Bane Free Radio Hour.
So, we've been talking about these characters, but there's some characters that we've been talking about, but kind of a roundabout way, and that's, you know, basically, you know, the universe that you're writing in with, you know, the 500, the fringe, planet. For the uninitiated potential fan, let's set that up for them. You know, who are these, you know, these characters, the big players in this universe, since we've been talking about the main characters?
Yeah. Ah, well, okay. In the beginning, there was no. Okay. Basically, the two big human polities are the Terran Federation and the Terran League. The Terran Federation is essentially the great, 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 great grandchild of the Western world today. The Terran League is essentially the great, 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 great grandchild of the Chinese Asian world. That's a gross oversimplification. But for various reasons growing out of wars on Earth and the pattern of interstellar exploration, you have the Terran League, which is dominated, heavily dominated by Chinese culture, Chinese language, etc., and had a long-standing sense of enmity with the Terran Federation, which is overwhelmingly built on a Western template. Okay. But it was basically more a matter of tradition than anything else until the Rish turned up. And the Rish are an alien species who are much more militant than humans are, hard though that is to be, and who recognized humanity as a threat because our populations grew faster. We liked lighter population densities on planets, so we expanded faster. And they're like, you know what, these guys are going to outgrow us really darn quick here if we don't prune them back. So they basically played for a long time, like the better part of 100 years. They're really good at playing the long game, okay? And they deliberately worsened the enmity between these two human polities until they could manipulate them into actually going to war with one another. All right. So once the war broke out, both sides, the war's been ongoing for going on 60 years at the point of these novels. The death toll has been horrendous. Occasionally entire planetary populations, usually colony worlds that don't have huge populations, but entire planetary populations get wiped out, like happened at Inverness in the first book. Very, very deep hatred between the two sides. In the Federation, which is where Murphy comes from, power has been very, very strongly concentrated in the hands of a group called the 500. The 500 comes from the 500 most powerful families in the Federation. It's actually got a lot more than just 500 families in it. It's a convenient loop. And the heavy industry that's making money hand over fist out of supplying the war machine and so forth, so forth, so on, is heavily concentrated in the heart worlds, the core worlds, the oldest colony worlds, which are in turn basically controlled by the 500. Whereas the fringe worlds, which are the colony worlds that most of them were established before the war broke out, but they still don't have huge populations on them, they have virtually, effectively, no political or economic power. They are ignored at the heart of the system. But they're who do most of the dying in this war. And this situation has been getting steadily worse for the last 40 years or so. And the fringe has now reached the breaking point. And Murphy has seen this coming, recognized that there are fissures in the Federation. They're going to split it wide open if they're not adjusted. And he strongly suspects, slash knows, that the Rish are involved, whether they're just fishing in troubled waters or they have some long-term strategy, he does not know. But then he finds out in the first book that the Rish are helping the League build a fleet of 50 carriers, which 50 carriers is roughly a quarter of the entire existing strength of the Terran Federation Navy. So that's how big a fleet they're building secretly for them in the first book, which convinces him that they have something really devious in mind, or they wouldn't be this deep into it. And so those are the poles, if you will, of the power / political equation that Murphy is maneuvering within. And he did not anticipate the fringe literally going up in flames when he set out in the first book. In the first book, his motives were far more modest, to uncover proof that the Rish were doing bad things. But no good deed goes unpublished, especially in a David Weber novel. And so he found himself eventually, basically had no choice but to climb up on the back of the tiger and hope he could hold on. And he is trying desperately, when this book opens, to be the Fringe's spokesman without becoming the Fringe's warlord. With a debatable degree of success. Okay. Yeah. Does that sound pretty much accurate, Richard?
Yeah. That's definitely there. But it's just to emphasize that the 500 didn't want to actually, you know, sacrifice anything for the sake of the war. They're the ones who are building the ships and making all the profit. And then they look to the fringe to actually pay the blood price to keep the war going.
Yeah. They're the ones who are at the mall while the fringe is at the war. Okay, except that it's even worse than that, because if you boiled it down and actually got them to face the truth themselves, they don't want the war to end because it's working so well for them. Okay, very few of them would actually admit that, but if you could get inside the closet of their brain, that is what you would see when you got there. I guess the best way to put it is it's a little bit like Hannah Arendt's banality of evil. Okay, they aren't actively evil in the sense of we want other people to die. It's worse. We don't care if other people die as long as we still have our chalet in the Alps. All right? Mm-hmm. And Murphy just can't stomach that. So I guess you could say that Murphy suffers from an excess of decency, at least from the 500s perspective. And there are characters like Esteban, the admiral who comes over to Murphy, that he and Hanratty have the history, kind of thing. And he comes face to face with the fact that Murphy's right. Okay. And once he comes face to face with the fact that Murphy is right, this guy who was like, oh no, becomes a Murphy paladin. You know, he's totally loyal to Murphy because he doesn't know if anybody can fix the problem, but if Murphy can't, nobody can. And so he is totally in Murphy's corner. And that's the kind of decisions that people are being forced to make in this book. Although I do like what's going to happen, Richard. I do like what's going to happen with the Dayu shipyard in the next book. I really
yes, that's gonna
okay.
be fun.
That's going to be fun. Yes. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, and I really like it because Murphy knows there's going to be consequences and he does it anyway.
Yeah.
And that's very compelling to other than he's like, oh, I'm the good guy. I'm going to do this thing and it's all going to be sunshine and rainbows at the end because I'm the good guy. But it's always so much better when there's consequences. It's the same if you're writing in fantasy, and I can do magic all day long, and I don't get tired, and it's all going to work out in the end. But a really good story is like, well, magic's hard, and
Murphy knows, and he's right. Okay, even at the end of the day, if he manages to, if not save the Federation, at least save what the Federation stood for when it was created, to preserve, to fight off the folks who want to destroy it and all the, you know, even if he manages that, the cost is going to be horrific. Okay. And not just the cost to humanity in general, but to his own family.
Yes.
Okay. He's already nearly lost Callum twice, okay? Ira has become, whether she really realizes it or not, she's become his second daughter, okay? I mean, that's absolutely the way that he sees her. And that's the way that she sees. She never had a father, so she doesn't realize, really, that that's how she sees him now. If you see what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And he damn near loses her in this book. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's got his older son and his daughter and Simmy are trapped in the belly of the beast, if it were. And he has no idea how or if he's going to be able to get them out. Okay. How is her dad going to be able to protect her? Okay, well, he's one of the most powerful members of the 500, but he's one of the most powerful members of the 500. Okay, so no, if they decide, you know, to crush him, he will be crushed. And Murphy knows that too. And all of that, it's, you know, if there was an ounce of give in his moral backbone, he would have thrown up his hands and never gone to Inverness. Okay. But he couldn't not do that. There's a telling passage in Governor where he and Hanratty are having a conversation right after he gets to Silvertree, right after they get Silvertree. And he says basically, okay, the cover of Murphy the Bumbler had to go out the airlock because I couldn't stand by and watch the surviving handful of people on Inverness die. And so it's earlier than we hoped, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the point at which Murphy really takes his first step into the open as a potential threat to the 500. It's very early days. It's very subtle, but that's the point at which he takes that first step across the threshold onto the path that is going to lead him into becoming the 500's worst nightmare. And unfortunately, the 500 has a lot of potential weapons to crush their nightmare. Okay, and he knows that too. The when he turns up at the naval base, okay, all he wants to do is talk. He just wants to send a message to the 500. That's it. He doesn't want to start a fight. He doesn't want to do, you know, any of this crap. And it spirals out of his control. And we basically make it a matter of, I think it's like 83 seconds. 83 seconds delay in the arrival of one of his messages kicks off this incredible spasm of bloodshed And it's not his fault. It's just if the message had gotten there 83 seconds earlier, it wouldn't have happened. But now it has. And we are all so screwed because it did, kind of thing. And that's what we've been doing to this poor guy.
I know, man. This guy's catching a beating.
Yeah. It's like, give me a break. Which vertebra? You know, I mean, it's that kind of a thing for him.
Yeah. Y'all do a very good job of making me feel for this guy.
Yeah. We feel sorry for him. Doesn't stop us from doing it. I mean, you
know. Well, and I'm not just blowing smoke because I'm interviewing you. This is a very compelling book. If you're a military sci-fi fan, of course, you're gonna love this book. If you love, you know, good characters, great storytelling, this book's gonna suck you in. It sucked me in. And my question is, when can we get more?
Okay, that's on my plate right now, because I got so much crap going on.
You are busy.
Well, I'm busy, and life has been conspiring to keep me from getting unbusy, with health issues and other little minor things like that. This and the sequel to Challenge Heaven with Chris Kennedy, those are two that I have got to sit down and find the time to brainstorm with Richard and Chris, and maybe get them started on the draft while I'm trying to club alligators over on the other side of the swamp. It's a novel experience. You should pardon the expression, novel experience, for me to be as, from where I sit, ineffectual in getting stuff done. Okay. Because there's so much stuff going on, and it's kind of like, I remember, a year or so ago, I was talking to Marla, at Maine, and I said, I just feel like I'm not getting anything. And she said, well, let me look. And she said, okay, we have you as like a lead release for the next five quarters, you know, kind of thing. But it doesn't feel that way from my end, because I know how much stuff I still need to get done, if you follow me.
Yeah.
And in some ways, collaborations are tougher than solo books. Because in a solo book, you're just chugging straight ahead, okay? And you're not having to stop and say, well, wait, we've gone in a different direction here, and let me think about it. Ooh, okay, I can see where this could be good, kind of thing. Collaborations, any story has a tendency to pretend it's kudzu while you're writing it, it does for me anyway, to grow and expand and go everywhere. Collaborations are both worse and better about that, because you have to be more structured approaching it, which restricts the original kudzu growth. Okay, but you have somebody else out there cheerfully throwing kudzu seeds around to help you while you're trying to not throw the kudzu seeds of your own around, if you follow me. And in Richard and my case, that frequently winds up is as what those who know me and love me refer to as an ooh shiny moment, where somebody shows me something shiny and I'm just like, yes, let's do that. You know, at least Richard hasn't killed the goldfish. That's
you know, it's when I was in the army, we had we called it the good idea fairy. And people were famous for, like, you know, the commander just got a visit from the good idea fairy. Oh no.
Yeah.
as a writer, you know, we call that the muse. And yes, when the muse whispers to you, you should probably listen. Yes. She won't let the idea go away.
Yeah,
she'll just sit there and keep, like, what if that character and the other character liked each other? You know, that kind of thing. And you're like, it's going to keep. So when the muse is whispering, sometimes you just got to listen.
Yeah, yes. Some people call it the muse. Some people call it voices in their head. You know, it's whatever. whatever works.
Well, yeah. Okay. Anybody who is going to do this successfully, in my opinion, okay, has to be the sort of person who would be doing it for him or herself, whether it was ever seeing print for anybody else in the first place. You know, you got to have that kind of compulsion to tell the story, because otherwise you're going to hit times where it's just too much work and there's too much other stuff life is demanding that you deal with. And so this is going to fall by the wayside and not get done. The problem is that you have to listen to the muse, but sometimes you have to tell the muse, sit down and shut up. I can't do that in this one. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, but there are other times, it's kind of like in the Honorverse when I killed off Andrew La Follette. Okay, I tried to tell the muse, sit down, shut up, I like Andrew, I'm not going to kill him. I tried 3, 4, 5 times to write that scene without killing him. And I could not do it. I couldn't do it. And it was only after I'd handed the manuscript in that I realized why. And the reason that I couldn't do it, I've explained this on panels, the reason I couldn't do it is Honor Harrington loses 90%+ of her family in the same attack that Andrew is killed in. But the reader has never met any but like 3 or 4 of that 90% of her family. They know she's a family person, she's close to them, but the focus has always been off Sphinx and so forth. So you don't know them. Okay, but you do know her relationship with Andrew. And when she loses Andrew, it opens her grief for all those other people to the readers who knew how much Andrew meant to her. And I did not realize until I handed the book in that that's the reason that I couldn't write that scene satisfyingly without his dying in it. I tried. Lord, I tried. I used the paddles 4 times. Okay, and each time, you know, I lost him again. Although I do have to say that it was easier for me to deal with in the end by reflecting the same way that Honor does at one point, which is basically if God had called him on the phone and said, you know, everybody's got to die, right? Uh-huh. Okay. How would you prefer to die? And given him, you know, that would have been the choice that he would have made. Okay. And that helped. But and there's a lot of that kind of loss and of price paying in the Murphyverse. Maybe even more than in the Honorverse. Because in the Honorverse, by and large, with the exception of the Mason alignment, you at least know who the position players are. Okay, and there are lines of battle. Honor's problems with Pavel Jung and so forth, they're purely personal. Okay, it's not the case of, and she has to look over her shoulder at a corrupt oligarchy the entire time she's trying to save the Star Kingdom of Manticore. In that respect, Murphy has a much heavier burden than Honor did. Okay. And I don't know. It's I've been having a discussion online about it's a Facebook thread about books for very young readers, stories for very young readers, and whether they should rip the bandage off and tell kids at a very early age that the world can be a terrible place, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And my judgment is that it's a terrible idea to rip that bandage off any sooner than you have to, because you have to build the kid first. Okay, you have to let the kid be a kid. You have to let the kid discover that, yes, there is goodness in the world. Okay. Because they're going to need that buttress when they run into the fact that there's also bad in the world. But they need to understand that bad is a part of what's out there, not everything there is. And I think with social media and so forth, we get kids programmed early into seeing only the ugly. Okay.
Well, yeah, that's something to fight for, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of, in a sense, what happened in the Murphyverse, is that everybody in the Fringe has had to have the bandage ripped off when they were 12 or 9 or 6, okay? And that's what they see when they look at the Federation. And nobody in the 500 cares, okay? So that's, you know. And one of the things that this story is about is, well, okay, that's true. But what the Fringe is finding out is what they should have known from the time that they were 7 or 9 or whatever, which is there are also good people out there and forces for good that will try to do something about all the crap. And that's who Murphy is. And we have, I know we can't see them sometimes because of all of the polarization and everything that we're looking at today. But we have people right now on both sides of the political divide who are trying to do something about it. And we've just got so much background noise going on now about how terrible both sides are that there's a sense of hopeless fatalism about where we're going and about any kind of possibility of, for want of a better term, healing the breach. But, you know, when the country is split almost evenly between the two camps, mm-hmm. okay, the only feasible solution is to find a way to heal the breach. And I sincerely wish that people on both sides of the political and ideological aisle would think about that from time to time. And it's something that Murphy is thinking about the entire time. So in a sense, while this book was conceived 30 plus years ago, okay, in that regard, without meaning it to, it's become a commentary in some ways on where we are right now. And that was not, it's not overtly political in that sense. And it's not trying to say, and this is how the current day problems must be resolved at all. It's looking at the fact that this is a situation in which, if you look at it as even-handedly as you can, you're looking at a situation where there is no practical likelihood of healing the breach between the 500 and the Fringe. So if you can't heal it, what do you do? Okay. Yeah. But like I say, you know, it was not by any means, by any means at all, was that where this was going when the storyline was conceived? Mm-hmm. Or what was it, a comment on anything current day at the time? I tend to use history a lot as the basis for what I'm doing. And I'm not talking politics and ideology so much as I'm talking history in these books, in the Honorverse, and in these too, in the way that I structured the universes. And Richard is coming from a lot of the same perspective. I think possibly because of his intelligence background and whatnot, he is a little more into the, you know, overt implications of the current political, military, international structure when we're working than I was when I set this up. And I think that brings some extra texture to it. But neither one of us is trying to beat anybody with an ideological club at any point in this. I think that the instant you start trying to do that, you kneecap the story.
At least for a portion of your audience, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, you not only for a portion of the audience, but for the story itself. because when you start forcing it to carry a particular political, ideological, whatever, when it becomes more important that you get that carried than that you have compelling characters, that you have characters the reader cares about, when you are clearly contriving situations solely to make a political point, okay, then you are doing yourself and the characters and the reader a profound disservice, in my personal opinion.
Well, and I agree, because I've read those books, and it kind of takes you out of it. But from my reading, I see some commonalities from, you know, our current world in this book. But to me, and it didn't come across preachy. It didn't come across one side or the other. It came across very compelling. So, oh, I can relate to this.
But that's what we—that's what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just the other thing we were trying to do is tell a good story. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have said this many times. Okay, but science fiction, you know, are the science fiction is the fairy tales of a technological society. Okay, it serves, you know, we don't have wizards and trolls. We have scientists and cyborgs. Okay, we don't have Pegasus, we have starships. But because those are the tropes that we're using because of the difference in our societies. But we're still telling stories that are supposed to entertain, but stories that are also, they can be inspirational, they can be cautionary, they can be explanatory, all those things, okay? And that's what this is. It's been said many times, and with a large degree of accuracy, that by the nature of the beast, science fiction is always more a commentary on the time the story is produced than on whatever universe is invented for the characters to deal with. And that's because the writer is a product of the time in which it was produced. Mm-hmm. I try in my writing to minimize that, because like I say, I'm writing history. And yet my interpretation of history is shaped by the time in which I live. So there's no way you can write science fiction that doesn't reflect your time and space. You can try and write it in a way that doesn't confine it to your time and space, that gives it a reach beyond your, you know, day-to-day warfare in the trenches of ideology and so forth. But I don't know anyone who can avoid that entirely. I can't conceive of how you might be able to avoid that entirely. So this is our effort to tell a story about human beings facing problems, recognizing responsibility, dealing with problems, exercising that responsibility, and what it may cost and what it can achieve. So that, you know, that's it.
Well, I think that is a nice button on this this interview, a ribbon, if you will. But before we go, first of all, thank you. Great book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. That's why I want to know when the next one's coming out. and, of course, I'm going to have to go read the first one now, because I've only had the pleasure of reading this one so far. But before we go, let's give you guys a chance to tell people where they can find you online, in person, and what things they should go check out. Richard, let's go ahead and start with you.
Sure. If you go into the Amazon box and type in Richard Falk, you can find me there. I suggest starting with, read Governor first. But if you like what's in there, and if you want to read more of my stuff, I suggest reading The Ember War. And that's a lot of people like that book.
Yep.
And then come by, and in the back of that book is all kinds of ways to get more free short stories and stuff from me and my mailing list. But then go to Facebook and go to Richard Fox Author and come say hi there. And it's always a party over on my Facebook page.
I would say in some cases it's not an orgy, just a party. I'm on Facebook. I'm not as much of a deliberate presence there as I have been at times in the past. But you can find me by doing Amazon searches. You can find me at Bain. By all means, go and look at Bain. If you're not familiar with the Bain Free Library, go find the Bain Free Library. You can find quite a few people there that you can get your toes wet without having to pay a bucket of money for. I will be at Dragon Con, and I will be at the Superstars Writing Conference in January. Those are the only two still on the calendar that I know about. And I'm sure that we will find out that we will be other places in the course of the year. Sharon and I actually were counting it up the other day, and we've been going to cons together since 1991.
Wow.
And we have done an average of 3 cons a year for that entire spread. So, you know, we're getting a little older. We're not quite as spry as we used to be. We'll probably be cutting down on it, but you will be seeing us still on the con circuit. And I should say that, just as a little teaser before I go, I have recently been in conversation with a pair of successful screenwriters and showrunners who have a slot at Amazon that they are thinking they might be pitching the Honorverse to.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
I hope that Amazon has failed me with my Henry Cavill and Warhammer, but I would much prefer to see the Honor Harrington universe.
Yeah,
it's very
early days. We've only had a couple of conversations. I really, really like these guys, and they really, really know the Arniverse. When we were talking, if I threw out a character's name, they knew exactly who I was talking about. So that makes me feel happy there. But like I say, it's very early days. It may come to nothing. But I had come to the conclusion some time ago that television is a better avenue for the Arniverse than movies anyway, because of the way that the books are laid out, the way the character arcs grow.
There's so many books.
Yeah, that would be an issue too. It's, you know, and one of the problems we had when Evergreen was trying to do it was the insistence on trying to make Basilisk Station work as the first movie in a possible franchise. And I love that book. I think that it lays out who Honor Harrington is, and you know, but all of the actions backloaded into the last third or so of it. And at the time, the novella Let's Dance hadn't been written yet. And Let's Dance, if for people who haven't read it, Last Dance is kind of the perfect pilot season for a series, because it's Honor's last command slot before she goes to the Crusher. And she goes against orders. She connives with the ballroom. She pisses off most of the Silesian Confederacy. All the things that we know and love about Honor, she does there. And at the end of it, she goes to the Crusher. So it would be like a perfect pilot, smaller cast, smaller characters, lets you get to see her. And then if you wanted to begin the series with Basilisk Station, you have her leaving the Crusher and taking over the Fearless in the first episode of the regular stuff. So, I think it would segue very well. But again, like I say, this is very, very early days. And we don't know what, if anything, will come of it. But I really liked these two, and they do have some significant chops in Hollywood. That's all I'm going to say right now about who they are.
Well, I'm excited, and I hope it does come to fruition, because I would love to watch that.
Yeah.
So, Richard, do you have any conventions that people can see you out in the wild?
I will be at, oh my, whatever they have changed the name for 20 books to 50K.
Yeah.
That's here in Las Vegas in November. I live in Las Vegas, so I'm always ready to go to that. Mm-hmm. But and I, if I have a book nominated for Dragon Con for the Dragon, if that happens, I don't mm-hmm. think the slots are out yet. If that happens, then I'll be at Dragon Con just walking around. And I told my readers that if they nominate my book, they get to pick my cosplay, which will be a mistake. So, absolutely will be a mistake, but you know, I made the promise, so we'll see what happens.
Richard, awesome. Richard,
have you ever seen Zardoz?
I'm gonna be scared now.
It's good for the fans, but why'd you do that to yourself?
You gotta get people excited, and for some reason Zardoz gets people excited. And I probably shouldn't delve into that too much. But.
No, you probably shouldn't. I don't know what it is about red diapers, but, you know, there you go.
Well, good luck with that, sir.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, like, no, I don't know him, guys. I don't know who that guy is.
Not that you need my 2 cents, but this was a great book. And if you like military science fiction, of course, go read The Honorverse, go read anything David's written. And Richard, you're a new author to me, but if this is any indication of what you've done in the past, go read all this stuff. It's going to be good. So go check it out. And like I always say, like, rate, review on all the wherever you buy books. It really helps your authors out, especially, you know, your new fledgling authors, but it also helps out your well-established authors as well. So if you like them, go help them out and sign up for their newsletter and all that good stuff. That's how you're going to keep up with all the news of what's going on with them and their writing. So gentlemen, I really appreciate y'all coming on. Richard, it was great meeting you. David, great. It's old home week. It's like the third or fourth time I get to interview. I had the pleasure of doing that. So thank you again. And for everybody out in TV land, we'll catch you next time.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the elven court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Tinker would have liked to create more of a plan, but she didn't dare plan anything with Chiyo prying into her mind. She finished the simple stun baton and tested it by pressing it against Chiyo. The kitsune collapsed into a satisfying heap of silk. Tinker bound and gagged her quickly, surprised to discover Chiyo had very sharp canine teeth, small furry dog ears, and a foxtail hidden under the kimono. Tinker swapped fresh batteries into the stun baton, glancing around. The warehouse had changed little, but that would almost be expected. The low windows had been painted black, so Chiyo wouldn't have to disguise anything outside. She bypassed the alarm on the outside door, cut off the padlock with a welding torch, and opened the door. She expected to be on Mount Washington. It was a view out her bedroom window, only from the Onihida perspective. Looking at the moonlit hills rising all around her, she realized that the view had been a complete sham. They were in a river valley someplace far from downtown. As she scurried down the alley, she decided that it was logical. The Oni would want to be as far out of the public eye as possible. Mount Washington, being far above the floodplain and yet close to downtown in the rim, was still heavily populated. She paused at the mouth of the alley, trying to get her bearings. She was in an industrial park of some sort, the long, tall warehouses standing dark all around her. Nothing looked like a stone castle, so her bedroom and the rest of the living spaces were probably in one of the warehouses, hidden from prying eyes. Fake. All of it. She peered around the corner. Surely there would be guards, unless they were afraid of advertising their presence. She dashed across the street to the cover of the next alley. It took her to the water's edge. Only 20 feet across, with high cement retaining walls for banks, the waterway was too narrow to be a river. Most streams in the area, though, flowed into the Ohio River eventually. A silvery leaf tossed down to the dark water pointed out which direction the creek flowed. Following the creek would take longer than striking off across country, but heading in a random direction might only take her deep into Elf Home Wilderness. Hopefully, Riki wouldn't be back soon. After 5 minutes of walking with a warehouse to her right, she realized how large the Oni complex was. The long building was easily a quarter mile or more long. There was a wide break, and then another long warehouse running alongside the creek. At the end of the second warehouse, a thick column of white limestone lit by moonlight drew her eyes upwards. A massive bridge spanned the valley in several graceful arches, totaling 1,600 feet long with a deck 200 feet above the creek. Even in the city of bridges, it was quite singular, and she recognized it. The bridge was the Westinghouse Bridge, which meant the Oni base was the old Westinghouse electric air brake plant. By blind luck, she had gone in the right direction, because the rim cut through just feet north of the plant. The erratic path of the Monongahela River and the rim effectively isolated this small slice of Pittsburgh. The Elfin Forest deeply encroached on the area, slowly whittling it down. Last she'd heard, something had killed and eaten the last human inhabitants. Now she wondered how much the Oni had had to do with that. No matter. Now she knew where she was. She knew where to go for help. She sold scrap to the converted USX steel mill just downriver. The mini mill operated 24 hours a day, melting down old steel to reforge it to slabs, which were sent upriver via barge to the rolling mill at Travosburg. It was less than 3 miles. Unfortunately, most of the steel workers now lived across the river, where miles of transplanted Pittsburgh buffered them from Elf Home Wilderness, but there were plenty of bars. Sticking to the water's edge would be slow, and considering the black willows and jumpfishes, far from safe. She decided to take a risk and follow the street.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz, and good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.